We've heard talk about models in some of the previous talks, and in many ways, yes, they're the bread and butter of groundwater management, but how are the intricacies of those models communicated, particularly to those that adjudicate groundwater resources? Mike Feenan will now share his experiences in this realm. Mike is a research hydrologist and acting deputy director of the, this is a long sentence, of the Integrated Modeling and Prediction Division at the, I told you, USGS Midwest Water Science Center. Right, okay. He got a BA in geology from McAllister and an MS and PhD from Stanford. His focus is on groundwater modeling with an emphasis on forecast uncertainty quantification, machine learning, and decision support in the face of uncertainty. So,
that'll be fine. Yep. Thanks. I have to say, following a talk about the LCCMR and being a native Minnesotan who moved to Wisconsin, I cry a little bit. all right, so exactly, that was a great introduction, covered kind of what I'm going to talk about here. But I wanted to have a picture that we sometimes see groundwater, right? Like, we go to a spring, and like, all the hydrogeologists are stoked, and they're like, it does exist, it's really there. I don't work in a vacuum, none of us do, but just because I may run out of time, I want to make sure that I acknowledge that the work that I'm going to talk about today is collaboration with a ton of really amazing people, and you know, really blessed to have a great diversity of people that I've been working with over the last few years. And so basically I'm gonna talk about three parts, you know, and after Jim's talk, I feel like this is a totally inadequate narrative, and I'm gonna build as much tension as I can, but but we're gonna start out with kind of what I was asked to talk about, which is this book called Adjudicating Groundwater. Part of that was also a workshop educating judges and justices in the West, which was kind of a mind-blowing experience that I'm happy to share with y'all. And then I want to go directly into one of my biggest failures of science communication. It was disastrous, ended up okay, but and that's related to the Little Plover River Project, which is a project I've worked on in Wisconsin a couple years ago. And in order to set up the failure and make it make sense, I'm going to talk a little bit about that project as well and kind of what led up to it. But we have to end, you know, back in a happy place. So I've got a bit of what I think has been a science communication success to share as well at the end. So how many people have seen this quotation of the rule of capture from the Texas Supreme Court in 1904? Yeah, a few people. So there's some great terminology in here. And I just want to start out by motivating why we have to model in the first place, right? So, and I'll just read this quickly. Because the existence, origin, movement, and course of such waters and the causes which govern and direct their movements are so secret, occult, and concealed that an attempt to administer any set of legal rules in respect to them would be involved in hopeless uncertainty. I call uncertainty kind of a cool thing. They call it hopeless. And would therefore be practically impossible, right? Like, that is strong language. A little bit of background about this. What happened was there was a farmer or a rancher in Texas, and the Texas Houston and Texas Central Railroad came through. These are steam engine days, right? So they needed a ton of water to fill up their steam engines to make steam and for, I think, a machine shop. They started pumping like crazy. Rancher's well goes dry. And everybody says, it is very obvious that this big extraction of water by the rail company is drying out that guy's well. Nobody's questioning that. What they're questioning is, how do you prove that in the court of law? And they basically said you can't at the time, right? Because water is secret, occult, and concealed. And this is 1904, right? So I actually, jumping ahead to the National Judicial College thing, I got to talk to the current Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court. And he put a little context around this. And he said, you know, in 1904, occult, it didn't mean like witchcraft and Ouija boards and stuff. It just meant that it was unknowable or unseeable, like in a different realm. That was so. it sounds colorful now. But yeah, so that was kind of the idea, and this was following on something called the rule of capture, which is like 1843 in Texas, which was that groundwater is basically a mineral right, right? Like if you can pump it out of the ground, go to town, it's yours. And so, and this was a big case to try to start to rethink that, but they didn't feel like they had the technology. Well, now we do with this fancy thing that we can call a model. And I find sometimes it's worth looking in the dictionary for definitions of things. And I actually really like this one. A simplified description, often mathematical, sure, of a system or process to assist calculations and predictions, right? So, I mean, that's it. That is what we're doing with the model. And the hope is that we can somehow dig in to these mysteries that are under the ground, right, with our limited data and what we can infer about the system and make some kind of meaningful calculation or prediction. So I think we all hope we can do that and maybe even claim we can do that, at least to some degree. All right, so part one, talking about the working with the judges and justices. And Adjudicating Groundwater is the name of this book that I was an editor of, but it came out of a project called Dividing the Waters. And this is part of the National Judicial College. This is a nonprofit organization in Reno, Nevada, and they educate judges and justices partly on law, but also a lot on technical things, all kinds of technical things. Like I get their email now, so you know, if I wanted to go take a class on like the accuracy of a breathalyzer test and how that, you know, compares to blood tests for deciding if you've had too much to drink, or you know, all kinds of technical issues, intellectual property, things like that. They do workshops and they write these books that they call bench books. So it's meant to be like an accessible compendium written by experts and contributed to by experts that provides kind of the background information that judges and justices need for their work. So, and there has been a history of surface water hydrology for at the National Judicial College. But because of recent drought, because of potential new regulation in places like California, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act that people have probably heard about, and also because just a better understanding of the integrated nature of groundwater and surface water, they decided to do a workshop. The Dividing the Waters group decided to do a workshop on groundwater. And right away, they jumped to the necessity for modeling to be part of that, of course. So so this workshop was held in November of 2017 at Baylor University in Waco. So I went down and taught at this. And it was not all about modeling. Actually, that was only like an hour or two, but then I had a lot of opportunity to talk to the judges and justices, including at a very fancy dinner in the stadium, because that's where you have fancy dinners in Baylor. Football. It was cool. and so, like a lot of, so it was focused on the West. And the reason it was focused on the West has to do with prior appropriations water law, which we don't deal with, you know, east of basically the Dakotas. And so the issue, I'm sure people are somewhat familiar with this, but just a quick review, like there's a seniority of water rights, right? So there's the senior user who often got their rights early or had bought them from the people that were there first, well, second. And normally there's just this cascade of priority. Well, when does that really become an issue? It becomes an issue if a senior user does something called a call on the river. And so they're basically saying, I'm demanding that I get my right, and I'm worried that there may not be enough water in the system. So junior users, you have to be limited so that I get my right as a senior user. You can imagine that on occasion, this is met with resistance and possibly even needs to be adjudicated, right? And so in surface water, it's a little more straightforward. It's often diversions out of a river. So the river flow goes down. You just tell people upstream they can't divert their water because the senior user downstream needs to get their right. And it's you know, there's still conflict, but it's a little more straightforward. However, now if there's a junior user or a user without any rights pumping like crazy near a stream, that can interrupt a senior right. And now the only way to get the only way to adjudicate that problem and come up with a solution to decide whether you have to curtail the rights of the junior user or not is going to require modeling and analysis. So a variety of, and you know, if this doesn't get resolved, it gets appealed. So that's why there are also justices, not just judges involved. There are appellate justices. There were, I think, 5 Supreme Court justices from Western states at the workshop. And then there's something called a special master, which is when a judge is assigned to basically adjudicate these cases all the time. So that was sort of the context that this workshop happened in. And on the way to that, we put together this book. And it's interesting, there was a draft given to the participants in the workshop, and they made some pretty extensive suggestions and edits that mostly we were able to accommodate. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So it's a short book. It's I don't know, 70 pages or something like that. And really just 4 sections. There's some background. And then there's some fundamentals of groundwater science that's pretty general. I think that I actually find it a useful, we put a lot of thought into defining terms, you know, the difference between storage coefficient and storativity and hydraulic conductivity and permeability and things like that. Interestingly, a lot of the judges were like, cool, I hear these terms, I still don't know what you mean. And I think, you know, we've heard a lot today about the value of story and kind of making our science and our information more accessible. I do feel like in some ways, the 2 sections on fundamentals of groundwater science and groundwater modeling are almost more useful for us as practitioners. And I don't think that they quite met the goal that we had of communicating these things to judges or people without a technical background. And I think storytelling and analogy and physical models and things like that really still play a very, very vital role in that kind of communication. That said, it's there are some useful things in there. For me, probably the most interesting part is the last, which is a judge's perspective. And there was a judge named Eric Wildman, dapper dude. He like has like custom suits and really long hair and these really fancy cowboy boots. And he and I were co-panelists for the workshop. And he adjudicates all kinds of water use issues in the West. So. It's kind of funny aside, he was supposed to introduce me, and we had only met, like, besides email, we had only met a little bit right before the presentation. And we got talking about the example that he had in the book about uncertainty. And I'm going to come back to this in more detail, but the long and short of it was he was told pretty much back to that 1904 case. He said, well, we know it's uncertain, but we don't have the tools, and it's really expensive computationally, and nobody knows how to do this stuff, so, like, we just can't do it. And I said, yeah, you know, that's actually not really true. I mean, not everybody knows how to do it, but we can, it's possible, you know, and we do have a lot of tools and techniques, and we teach classes, and we're getting better, you know. So when he introduced me, he said, well, 15 minutes ago, I learned that I had been hoodwinked. And we're going to revise the book, and apparently there are ways to do this. Which is good, because it's kind of my whole career. But anyway. But what it does bring up a really important point, though, which is that the judicial process relies on standards. I mean, it would be folly to say that the judicial process is truly objective. I mean, nothing is objective, right? But we certainly try, and they certainly try. And they want to fall back on very specific standards that they can implement over and over, right, from case to case. That's their goal. And so they spend a lot of time asking us, what are the standards that people use for groundwater modeling, right? And anybody who's ever made a groundwater model knows that their model is very special, and it's much more complicated than you understand. I had to do some really creative stuff, you know, and then it didn't converge. And so I had to, you know, fairy dust and, like, I mean, we try, right? We try as an industry to have best practices. And like you guys are doing, you know, making white papers, and there are various standards out there. But there is not like sort of a book that you pick up and just like do step one, do step two. There are several, right? But it was interesting. So he fell onto two things, which I still think are useful for us to understand as practitioners. And one of them is the admissibility of evidence and something called the Daubert standard. It comes from a case that the plaintiff was Daubert. And this does kind of fit into, we can fit into this framework pretty well, I think. You know, have these things been tested? Are you, have the theories that you're using been subjected to peer review and publication? Like, are you just making stuff up, or are you using something that, you know, other people have also used? A key thing is the known error rate. Is there a known error rate to this technique? That gets to uncertainty, which, again, I'll come back to in more detail. And then, is the model subject to standards? And, you know, and he says, you may wish to discuss the ASTM standards or other technical guidelines if offered by the parties. Or who uses the ASTM standards when they make a model? I think I saw three hands. So, I mean, this is what a lot of judges are going to look at to decide whether your model is worthwhile. And I didn't even know that they existed. And I don't think I'm dumb, but I didn't know. So I'll talk about them in a minute too. And then does the model and its underlying theories and techniques have widespread acceptance? Like, is this something that is used over and over again? This is part of the inertia that makes things like ModFlow get used a lot, right? Because it's been used before and people have made decisions based on it before. So there is this ASTM standards, and it's not particularly long. It's quite wordy. I just took out the sections here. But, you know, and these are common sense things that make a lot of sense. Is there a good conceptual model? Did you find the existing data? Did you evaluate whether you need more data to add to that? Good. How did you select your modeling and computer code? What are you using? In the United States, you're probably using ModFlow or GFlow or one of Otto's MATLAB things, but, you know. And then detailing how the model was constructed, how it was calibrated, and then here we go again, determining the adequacy of the model. This is very similar to the error rate, right? Like, there is a desire to have the uncertainty actually quantified. And then, have there been predictive simulations that are basically answering the question at hand? So the problem that Judge Wildman talked to me about was actually pretty simple, and it's in the book. But basically, there was a case, I think it was called Rangan, and there was this discussion among the experts in the court about whether there was a known error rate for the model. And they said, well, this is when they said, it's too impractical, we don't understand that stuff. They said, but we can tell you that there's a 10% error rate in the observations. So therefore, there must be a 10% error rate in the predictions made by the model. All right, there's too many people to sort of ask this like as a question, but what's wrong with this? Are your models perfect? Like, no, right? Are the new forcings that you're going to use to base your prediction on perfect? No, definitely not. Is 10% a likely actual uncertainty of the data that are going into the model? I'm like, hell no. There's no way. We don't know any of this stuff perfectly, right? So it's the wrong question. Like, the certainty that we have of the data that went into the model is, I would argue, a small piece of a much bigger puzzle, which is, how good is the model? How good are the techniques? How accurate is your computer? You know, did you use 32-bit or 64-bit? All those things matter to smaller and larger degrees. I'm looking at Rich because I know I know you're going to agree with me. But so I think the bigger and so after this discussion with Judge Wildman, we did get into the book that just isn't enough. And what we need to be thinking about is at least an estimate of the uncertainty of the prediction made by the model. And that is a bigger bar. That is a heavier lift. That is not something I learned about in undergrad. That is not something that is you know, universally known and maybe taught as much as it should be. But there are tools. Probably people have used this tool. And I know a lot of people in the room have worked with John Doherty at various times, and he's come and taught classes here. And there was this big effort to make a tool that is model independent, and that cascades uncertainty from observations out to predictions. This can all be done. And it's difficult, but it can be done. And I think it's a service that we kind of owe as a community. Now I'm thumping the pulpit a little bit. So the book, everybody gets a book. They're not selling the book. It's if you're a judge, you can write to the Judicial College and get it for free. But Kate asked me if I would talk to the Judicial College and see if they'd let us distribute the PDF, and they were kind enough to do so. So I guess it's on the website behind a password, and there are a few printed copies. So don't look under your seat; it won't be there. So I'm going to move on to talk a little bit about the Little Plover River in Wisconsin. And who has seen the Little Plover River movie by the USGS? All right, cool. Quite a few people. So we know how this river works, right? You pump water out of the ground near the river, and the water level goes down, and then the flow in the river goes down, and you recover the river, you turn off the pumps, the water level comes back up, the flow in the river comes back up. But wait, there's more. If you pump out of the river, you can see that it lowers the water table nearby in the groundwater. And when you stop pumping out of the river, it recovers, right? QED. This is great. This movie is amazing. And if you haven't seen it in a while, you should see it. It's super dated. You will see a lot of crew cuts and cigarettes, really cheesy looking hand-drawn stuff, and the music sounds like it's from Chips or Starsky and Hutch or something. But it is fantastic. It is completely clear. They define all of their jargon and terminology. They walk you through the process. The graphics are, again, very dated, but very, very clear and accurate. And you know, you can't write a paper right now saying that mass is conserved. It would be hard for any of us to go out and pump a river and monitor the results and then publish a paper and say this is novel, right? However, in Wisconsin, politically, this is novel. So, I'm not going to say anything about like party affiliations or anything like that. I'm just going to say that there's a huge pushback on the idea that groundwater and surface water are connected in Wisconsin. And if anyone's around for a beer later, we can talk about details about that. However, if we look at where the Little Plover River is, it's in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin, which is that white blob on the far left. And the black dots in this middle blow up show agricultural high capacity wells. Actually, not all of those are agricultural, like maybe 50 of them are industrial. But the other 1,500 or 950 are agricultural. And then you can blow up even more into the Little Plover River. It's kind of right in the middle of this yellow map, and there are quite a few agricultural wells around it. And so there is not a legal mechanism in Wisconsin to curtail existing pumping rights. That's impossible right now. Depends on who you talk to, but I'm pretty sure it's impossible. It's certainly not obvious. But the DNR was really... really forward-thinking a few years ago. They wanted to start to look at, well, what if we could start to manage this area as a basin altogether? That would mean maybe allowing more pumping in certain areas, maybe curtailing pumping in others. This is not without controversy. I mean, it's a huge deal. But they wanted at the beginning to at least know technically, do we even have the tools? Do we even have ways to use models to do this in a reasonable way? And I had been involved in some work in Nebraska doing constrained optimization, where we were looking at, you know, can you limit the amount of pumping, or can you maximize the amount of pumping subject to keeping water in a stream? So maximum agricultural output that doesn't violate the stream condition. And so we had done that in Nebraska, and they wanted to see could we do. But the first question, especially among our colleagues, was looking back at that movie, right? Like, why is there a study of the Little Plover River? Like, we know how this works. And so what was new? Well, there were some new techniques and modeling, obviously, in the last 50 years. We wanted to use this. It was called the Groundwater Management Module from ModFlow 2005. This is a optimization code, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But we also wanted to rethink how we engage with the stakeholders, and that's why I'm bringing up this project. Because I would say as scientists, we kind of have this, you know, our best practices are something like this for the model process. We collect data. This is going to sound a little ASTM-like, right? We construct a model. We compute the solution to the model, and we evaluate how well that matches what we've observed. It probably doesn't at first, so we cycle this thing a bunch of times, right? That's good practice. That's smart. And then eventually we drop a giant tome out and say, like, here's a report. And we expect people to believe everything along the way and those results. And we're good about trying to do, you know, public meetings and websites and things like that. But I think it's, we collectively thought it was really important to break this down to every step and spend time with all the stakeholders at every step. We're going to collect data. Let's talk about what kind of data we're going to collect. Let's talk about what this could possibly mean just looking at the data. And even trying to get input, one thing I didn't frame quite right is, you know, the big tension here is agriculture and kind of environmental and lake groups and river groups, right? So the farmers are saying we're not having an impact, or it doesn't matter if we're having an impact because it's too important to keep the economy going. And the environmental groups are saying, like, you guys have to stop. And I mean, pretty big fights. Like, the first public meeting we had, like, literally people in tears and screaming and yelling, you know, like, really, really strong passions all around this. So we wanted to not only work with the stakeholders at every step of the way, we also wanted to give them ownership of the process. We wanted them to be at the table, not just listening, but at the table and providing information. So collecting data, we spent a ton of time actually going out and getting data from the farmers, and even trading, like offering to survey in some of their wells that they wanted the elevations on if they would give us the water level data from the wells, then we could put in the model and we could say, this is your data in the model, right? And I think there's some power to that. So that meant a lot of windshield time and a lot of talking to, but more importantly, I would say listening to the stakeholders from the various perspectives. Ironically, we got criticized. So by we, I'm saying the co-PI was Ken Bradbury, who's the state geologist in Wisconsin, and me with the USGS. And we got beat up pretty hard by the environmental groups because they said, well, you're not giving us presentations and you're not reaching out to us and you keep talking to the farmers. And we said, well, we're answering the phone. Like, I mean, they're the people that want to talk to us. And, you know, and they have the biggest doubt and the biggest criticism of the work. So I think it was worthwhile in the end. This guy standing in the foreground here is one of the top 10 wealthiest agriculturalists in the United States. And he has a huge amount of influence in this part of the country. So, and a very colorful, interesting guy. more stories for beers. But anyway, So we went out to the farms. We went out and looked at the center pivots. We asked them, how does the center pivot work? It actually, has anyone used SWB, the soil water balance code? Maybe not. The way irrigation runs in SWB changed because of what these guys told us, because we were simulating something that wasn't meeting the way that their practice actually works. The science was fine. The implementation was not. So anyway, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of time. Some of that in kind of more formal settings, and a lot of it just windshield time and hanging around. And don't worry, I'm building tension, right? We're going to get to the failure, but there were a couple things that I'm proud of on the way there. And one of them was, you know, in Wisconsin, there's mandatory pumping for high capacity wells, reporting to the DNR, but it's monthly. So it doesn't really make sense for us to divide our stress periods smaller than monthly steps. And some of the farmers handed me this, and they said, we record our pumping every day. So, like, your model's garbage. That doesn't make any sense. If you're using it every month, we pump every day, and that's wrong. And so so the first thing we did is had a long discussion about the value of spreadsheets. Which it totally got, actually. It was a good conversation. And then what Ken Bradbury did was made just a cheesy kind of like simple model of just one center pivot really near one of the creeks. And this is actually one of the ones that was, I think this is actually the well and the place on the river near where the movie was made. So and so we just replicated the field data, you know, showed what we can see just with a simple model. But then we looked at the actual pumping schedule. So this is for their pumping year of 2014. And you can see the drawdown at the irrigation well, and the pumping is the green bars at the bottom there. And so, yeah, the thing's turning on and off all the time. And one of the reasons that we got so much pushback about saying that there's depletion of water from this stream is that every time you pump and you turn off the well, it pretty much recovers to the same spot, right? So the thinking was we're in balance with the water that's coming into the system, right? So we looked at then what does that do to the monitoring well that's nearby? That's what the center image here is, and then base flow in the creek. And you can see that, yeah, there's some noise in here, but the really important thing is these two little arrows on the far right show that at the end of the season, it has not recovered all the way from one well, right? There is actually net depletion out of the aquifer. And then there were three ways to divide up the time. We could either average everything to the month, we could use the daily that they were giving us, or we could take the months but kind of prorate them to when they really started irrigation, so it was a little bit better lined up. And the three curves, it doesn't really matter which is which. The point is they're not that different. And at the end of the month, when the pumping stops, everything kind of comes back to an equilibrium, and you have pretty much the same conclusion at the end of the pumping season. This was a bunch of work. You know, it's a pretty simple model, but it was a bunch of work for Ken to do. You know, it was a couple days. But when we brought this back and we communicated this with the farmers that had objected, they really appreciated it, and they trusted it. You know, they I think that was a really important way to gain trust and to help us collectively understand the system. It's not like we understand it and tell them, right? Like we are collectively trying to figure out how the system really works. Leading up to failure, this optimization technique requires something called depletion potential, which very simply is you can run a model with no pumping simulated, and then you can run a model with one well simulated, and you know the volume of water that you pumped, and you know the volume of water of decrease stream flow, right? So you use this simple equation to get a ratio. If I pump that well at 1 gallon, you know, per unit time, and I see that the stream has depleted half a gallon per unit time, that's 0.5 over 1, that means half of the water pumped from that well is coming at the expense of the stream. All right, well, we can do that systematically for every well in the area. And anyone who's familiar with the analytical solutions for stream depletion will see that it's basically a function of distance, right? So as you get away from the stream, you have less impact. This brought up some really interesting questions of fairness, because there was discussion about how much curtailment would be required to get this river to return up to a specified level. And a lot of people argued, well, everybody should have to pay the same tax in a sense, right? Everyone should be reduced by the same amount. Well, that means some of these green wells are being reduced, but they're not having an impact on that stream anyway. They're impacting some other stream. There was a lot of discussion around this, and we found these maps useful. But one of the things the DNR asked me to do was to evaluate, well, what would happen if we just simulated turning off the most impactful well, and then look at the stream, and then look at the next most impactful well, and look at that rise. How many wells would we have to curtail in order to be able to get the stream flow to where we want it? So being a Python nerd that I am, I was like, I can make a movie. This is going to be amazing. This is going to be so cool. And so I made one, and it's this. So it's a little bit complicated. I'm going to just walk you through quickly. The color scale is different, but the concept is the same on the right. We're looking at the depletion potential for all the wells around the area. On the left, these are four graphs that represent four locations going downstream in the Little Plover River. And the curve is showing, right now, there's a black dot on the far left. That means no wells have been removed. What is the flow in the river? Every time we remove a well, theory would tell us that the flow in the river should increase a little bit, right? So the x-axis in each one of these is how many wells have been removed, and the y-axis is the flow in the river, So remove wells, flow goes up, right? There are two targets, that's the dashed lines. Don't worry about that. We're trying to attain one of those. But why not make a movie? That's going to be so cool. Yeah. So we start removing wells, and this thing starts like moving along the curve. This is very exciting. And it's really steep at the beginning. Like the physics is, there's a lot of insight in here, right? Like the most impactful wells have the biggest impact. The stream starts to recover really fast. Oh my God, this is great. You only have to take out a few to reach our threshold, but we can just keep going. And eventually it kind of flattens off. That's also super cool, right? Because now we're starting to remove wells that don't have much impact and it's not really changing anything. That's great. So these black dots look like a disease, right? Like it looks like a pox. And the farmer who, I won't say his name, but I know him, who owned the first black dot that I put and snuffed out his entire life, right? Threw his notebook on the ground and stormed out of the meeting that we were having and didn't say anything. He just left. And everybody else was furious. I mean, red-faced, angry, right? And I was like, but it's so cool. And honestly, I don't know how I would make this differently. You could make an X. You could make a smiley face. I don't know, right? But I got distracted by the excitement of the science and even worse, the excitement of coding, because, right? But and missed a really important point. So the next time we presented this was to that room. What you can't see are the police that were at the doors. And so it actually ended up being a pretty simple answer. I showed the same video to this huge group of citizens. But the big difference was I spent probably 2 minutes like laying out why this was not a proposed solution. This wasn't reality. Every one of those dots represents a livelihood of a family and a business. And we're not saying that that's what we would do. This is the cold, hard facts of the science. This is the most efficient, and efficiency is not fair, right? Efficiency is expedient. And that's how I laid it out. And when I showed it, you know, like the police didn't have to get involved and it was okay. People were mad about other things. But so anyway, the moral of this is, I think, you know, when we're going to convey something like this, we need to be empathetic. We need to think about the potential ramifications of what we're talking about. We're not really talking about groundwater. Most people don't care about groundwater, but dollars matter, livelihoods matter, right? So, and a little framing, I think, can go a long way. And that, I think, was successful in this case. All right, so I'm totally running out of time, but this is short, I promise. But I wanted to end on a higher note, like a success. So another case that I worked on, for a while I was working on the Gogebic Taconite Mine, which was in northern Wisconsin, and the Central Sands and the Frac Sand Mines all at the same time. It was awesome. It was like the trifecta of controversy. And so in Chippewa County, which is just north of Eau Claire, there were a bunch of frac sand mines that had gone in, and we were working, I think some people in this room might have been at some of those meetings, and we were just working with the county to make a model of the county and look at impacts. And one of the things that the county conservationist there, this guy named Dan Masterpole, is just like awesome, forward-thinking person. And he had the idea that before we did these big public meetings with a couple hundred people, we should have like a show and tell thing out in the hallway. And somebody brought up the idea of, you know, the sand tank model, which probably everybody has seen from University of Wisconsin Stevens Point. This thing is great, right? Because it's not really a model. It's like, it's earth, it's reality. Like you put water in and you make it move. You make it move by simulating what a well does, right? Well, I looked at this thing, and then I looked at my computer, and I was like, these are like, my monitor actually is like the same size as that thing. So so I made a ModFlow model of the sand tank, and anybody who came by, and like people are attracted to the shiny object. They're like, oh, a computer thing. What's this all about? I'm like, I'm not going to tell you. Go look at that sand tank. And then they go over and go through the whole spiel of pumping and then, you know, I set up a few scenarios, like got the hydraulic conductivity reasonably right, and then maybe hard to see, but there are some arrows here showing that flow is generally to the river, and if you pump below the aquitard, you draw down the river a little bit, but not too much, and if you pump both below and above, you can actually start removing water from the river, you know. And it was really satisfying to say, and this is the exact same tool we're using in the project. Like, all these results you're about to see that look all fancier and stuff, it's the exact same tool. Not kind of exactly the same. So I think that was useful. And against my better judgment, I've posted a link to a little video demonstration I made of this. Please don't hate me. It's pretty cheesy. But I just kind of walked through the whole thing, you know, and so, well, enough of that. Right. So we have really big bridge gaps to bridge, you know, between science and the law, between the physical and model worlds, and between expectations and practicality. This gets back to Judge Wildman, right? Like, you know, things may be more practical than people give credit for. Framing is really important, and empathetic listening goes a long way. I think we just need to always be putting ourselves in the position of the people that anyone we're talking to, and try to understand not only how things might affect them, but also listening deeply to their questions and honoring the fact that when people ask a question, you know, even if it seems really off base and you can't even understand how it relates to what you're talking about, they think it does, right? They are thinking about a way that there's a connection, and you need the key to good communication then is to get inside of their head and understand what they're asking and why, and meet on that common ground.
So with that, we have time for maybe a couple of questions for Mike. Do we have any questions? Jim.
I guess I have a quick one. Jim Almendinger again. Could you comment on the difference between model calibration versus validation? And is validation really a different thing than calibrating? And if we have a data set, why wouldn't we calibrate to everything we have instead of dividing it up arbitrarily into a calibration versus validation data set?
Yeah, so there's a really great paper from the 90s by Naomi Oreskes and Ken Bellitz, and I can't remember, a few other co-authors, talking about why this is a real challenge. I don't like either of those words because I'm a Bayesian, so... so to me, there is no calibration. I mean, what we're really doing is we're conditionally finding the most likely model that meets the data, and but as so that's just kind of a semantic thing. The way that in machine learning and other statistical work that I do, typically we do validation, so you do hold out some of the data for that, but then at the end of the process, you reincorporate all of that. So yeah, you shouldn't leave anything on the table. But in like big complicated groundwater models, typically don't even leave anything out. So
wait, you have a question? It's impossible.
Oddly enough, I do. So pest. Parameter estimation. I guess it's been my experience that if you try and explain that to a general lay audience, it's pixie dust, and it makes your model a lot less believable. I wonder what's been your experience and how to make it believable.
Well, one of the things is I make a lot of use of Monte Carlo. Well, I should say I'm a government researcher, right? So I'm not in court, and I was a consultant, but I'm not anymore. So the needs of my explanation to people differ, and I acknowledge that. But it has been my experience that I use a lot of Monte Carlo, and you can show that you know, okay, here's a parameter, and we don't really know it perfectly, so here's kind of the range that we think it might fit in, and here's another one and another one. And then the results of that, right, are the uncertainty. I find that that's way easier to explain. And there are tools in particularly in PEST++, the new version of PEST, that make that really easy. So, and the other thing is I really like characterizing uncertainty as risk rather than uncertainty. And so basically the idea is you know, you have a distribution of your output, right? And we know it's not perfect, so we've got some kind of range here. And we just say, do we want to favor protection of the environment? and therefore we would edge the model toward, you know, toward one way? Or do we want to say, actually, the economic or the social aspects are more important, and we're willing to risk the environment a little bit more and move the other way? But then once we decide on that kind of general concept, we lock it down and use a single value, right? So we're making use of the uncertainty, but we're still giving decision makers a single number. Because, yeah, and definitely, I mean, I make my whole life like trying to understand and then publish and explain this stuff, and I get lost, right? So, and I know people don't want to hear, like, well, then you calculate the Jacobian, and then you use the Gauss-Levenberg Marquardt, you know? Like, people don't want to hear that stuff. So, I guess the only other thing I can say is like whether you can build trust with the people that you're talking to that you're doing. I mean, you also don't explain the differential equations under modflow. Usually, you just say this is a model; it faithfully represents the system, and there's a certain amount of trust you need to gain there. But yeah, good question, and it is still a challenge.
Yeah, this is Ellen, Minnesota DNR. I have a question since nobody else has one. So you mentioned Monte Carlo simulations, and I've been working on a project with a groundwater model at the DNR, and my God, pest calibration is just, it just really takes you to a dark hole. And so I keep thinking, is the world ready for us to just run a whole bunch of Monte Carlo simulations and just throw away calibration altogether?
I mean, you can, and actually our practice in my group in Wisconsin now is that we typically run Monte Carlo at the very beginning. Like once your model is sort of converging and like it passes the laugh test a little bit, we run Monte Carlo and just try to see. And maybe, yeah, and I think in a lot of circumstances that may be enough. And pest and calibration and validation, these things are not magic, right? And as a Bayesian, everything is conditional on everything that you put into it, right? So how you weight your data, how many iterations you decide to use, how big your grid cells are, did you use the well package or did you use, you know, some analytic wells, blah, blah, blah. All those things, those all matter. So when people say, well, pest gave me this answer, like, no, you gave yourself the answer and used this tool as part of your suite of tools. And I think when we think that way, it's easier to keep inserting our intuition and knowledge into it and not worrying about, did pest say that it converged and finished and that's what we take as somehow truer, you know? So with that in mind, yeah, if you just do Monte Carlo from the start, like maybe that's all you need.